that the Baker Hydes had arrived so informally dressed, he might have been less anxious. As it was, all he could picture was the disappointed face he thought his mother would turn on him if he stepped into the saloon, done up like a sloppy, bloody schoolboy. Then another, much odder thing happened. As he was going crossly through the drawers, he heard in the empty room behind his back a sound. It was a splash. Soft, but quite unmistakable. So he guessed at once that something on his washing-stand must somehow have toppled into the bowl. He turned to look, and couldn't believe his eyes. The thing that had found its way into the water was his missing collar. Automatically he darted across to fish it out. And then he stood with the collar in his hand, trying to figure out how such a thing could possibly have happened. The collar had not been on the washing-stand. He was positive of that. There was no nearby surface it could have slipped from, and no reason for it anyway to slip. There was nothing above the stand that might have held it and then let it drop. No dangling light, no sort of hook, even supposing that such a thing as a stiff white collar could have found its way up, unnoticed, to a light or a hook in the first place. All there was, he said, was the faintest sort of smudge on the latticework plaster ceiling above his head. At this point he was baffled, but not unnerved. The collar was dripping soapy water, but a wet collar seemed to him to be better than no collar at all, and he dried it off as best he could, then stood at his dressing-table mirror to fix it to his shirt and to tie his necktie. After that he had only to fasten his cuffs and grease and comb his hair, and he would be ready. He opened up the little ivory tub in which he kept his dress cufflinks, and found it empty. This, he said, was so absurd and so exasperating, he laughed. He had not seen the lynx that day with his own eyes, but just that morning he had accidentally knocked against the tub with his fingers, and he remembered very clearly the rattle of the metal inside. He had not touched the tub since then. He couldn't believe that Betty or Mrs. Baisley had removed the lynx, or that Caroline or his mother could have come and taken them away. Why would they have? He shook his head and glanced around and addressed himself to the room, to the fates or spirits or whatever it was that seemed to be playing games with him tonight. "You don't want me to go to the party?" he said. "Well, how about this? I don't want to go either. But once not in it, I'm afraid. Just give me back my fucking cufflinks, will you?" He closed the ivory tub and returned it to its place beside his comb and brushes, and in the very second of drawing back his hand he saw, through the dressing-table mirror and from the corner of his eye, something small and dark dropping down in the room behind him, like a spider dropping from the ceiling. It was followed almost immediately by the striking of metal against china, a crash so relatively violent in that still room it frightened the life out of him. He turned and, with a rising feeling of unreality, walked slowly over to the washing-stand. There, at the bottom of the bowl, were his cufflinks. The stand itself was splashed, the cloudy water in the bowl still heaving and slopping about. He put back his head and looked up. Again, the ceiling was seamless and quite unmarked, except that the smudge he had noticed before was now considerably darker. This was the moment, he said, when he realized that something really uncanny was at work in the room. He couldn't doubt his own senses. He had seen the cufflinks drop, and had heard the tremendous splash and rattle of them in the bowl. But where on earth could they have dropped from? He drew over his armchair and stood precariously on it to examine the ceiling at closer range. Apart from that queer, dark smudge, there was nothing. It was just as if the lynx had materialized into, or out of, thin air. He got heavily down off the chair, his leg beginning to hurt him now, and peered again into the bowl of his washing-stand. A whitish scum was already closing over the surface of the water, but all he had to do was put back his sleeve and dip in his hand to fish the cufflinks out. But he couldn't bring himself to do it. He didn't know what the hell to do. He thought again of the brightly lit saloon, his mother and sister waiting, the Desmonds, the Rossiters, the Baker Hydes, even me and Betty, all of us waiting, waiting for him, with glasses of sherry in our hands, and he began to sweat. He met his own gaze in his circular shaving-glass, and seemed to see the beads of perspiration rising, like worms, from the pores of his skin. Now, however, came the most grotesque thing of all. He was still gazing at his own sweating face when, to his disbelief and horror, the shaving-glass gave a sort of shudder. The glass was an old Victorian one, a beveled circular mirror in a pivoted brass frame on a porcelain base. It was, as I knew myself, pretty heavy. Not a thing that would slip if nudged or shaken by footsteps on the floor around it. Rod stood perfectly still, in that still room, and watched as the shaving-glass shuddered again, then rocked, then began to inch its way across the washing-stand towards him. It was just, he said, as if the thing were walking, or rather, as if it were in that moment discovering its own ability to walk. It moved with a jerky, halting gait, the unglazed underside of its porcelain base making a frightful, grating sound on the polished marble surface.
"It was the most sickening thing I ever saw," said Rod, describing it to me in a shaking voice and wiping away the sweat which had started out again on his lip and forehead at the memory. "It was all the more sickening, somehow, for the glass being such an ordinary sort of thing. If—I don't know— But if some beast had suddenly appeared in the room, some spook or apparition, I think I would have borne the shock of it better. But this—it was hateful. It was wrong. It made one feel as though everything around one, the ordinary stuff of one's ordinary life, might all at any moment start up like this and overwhelm one. That was bad enough. But what happened next?"
What happened next was even worse. All this time Rod had been watching the glass make its shuddering way towards him, sick with horror at what, to me, he kept calling the wrongness of the thing. Part of this wrongness was his sense that the glass was acting somehow impersonally. It had, God knew how, become animate. But he had the feeling that what was animating it was blind, thoughtless motion. He felt that if he were to put his hand flat on the glass's path, the porcelain vase would find a creeping, dogged way over his fingers. Naturally, he did not put his hand there. If anything, he shrank back. But he could still see that the glass was now approaching the edge of the marble stand, and he felt a horrible fascination in watching it teeter and fall. So he kept his place, a yard or so away from it. The glass crept onwards until an inch, and then a second inch of its base was projecting over the marble edge. He seemed to see the thing groping for another surface. He saw the mirror tilt as, unbalanced, the base rocked forward. He actually started to put out his hand in an automatic impulse to keep the thing from tumbling, but as he did it, the glass suddenly seemed to gather itself for a spring, and the next moment it had launched itself at his head. He twisted away and caught a stinging blow behind his ear. He heard the shattering of the mirror and the porcelain vase as the glass struck the floor behind him. He turned and saw the pieces lying harmlessly on the carpet as if just knocked there by a clumsy hand. It was at exactly this moment that Betty returned. She tapped at the door and, tense and startled, Rod cried out. Confused by the sound of his voice, she timidly pushed the door open and saw him gazing, as if transfixed by it, at the broken object on the floor. Not unnaturally she moved forward, meaning to tidy up the pieces. Then she caught sight of his expression. What he said to her he couldn't afterwards recall, but he must have spoken pretty wildly, for she left him at once and went hastily back to the saloon. That was when I saw her going in a flustered way to whisper in Mrs. Ayres's ear. Mrs. Ayres went straight back with her to Roderick and realized immediately that something was terribly wrong. He was sweating worse than ever now, and shaking like a man in a fever. He must have looked, I suppose, pretty much as I'd just seen him when he told me this story. His own first impulse on seeing his mother was, like a child, to clutch at her hand. But he'd also gathered his wits enough, he said, to know that he mustn't, in any way, involve her in what was going on. He had seen the shaving-glass make that spring at his head. It hadn't been animated by a senseless impulse, then. He had felt it driven at him by something extraordinarily purposeful and vicious. He didn't want his mother exposed to that. He gave her a confused, fragmented account of having overtaxed himself at the farm, and told her his head was aching so badly it felt like it was splitting in two. He was so obviously ill and upset, she wanted to send for me, but he wouldn't let her do it. He wanted only to get her out of that room as quickly as he possibly could. The 10 or so minutes she spent with him were, he said, some of the most dreadful of his life. The strain of trying to conceal what he had just been through, combined with his fright at the prospect of being left alone, perhaps to go through it all again, must have made him seem like a madman. Once he almost broke down in tears. And then, he said, it was only the look of dismay and anxiety on his mother's face that gave him the strength to pull himself together. When she and Betty left him, he sat on his bed in the corner of the room, with his back to the wall and his knees drawn up. His injured leg was throbbing, but he didn't mind it. He was almost glad of the pain, for keeping him alert, because what he had to do now, he said, was watch. He had to watch every object, every corner and shadow in the room, had to keep his gaze moving restlessly from one surface to another, for he knew that the malevolent thing which had tried to hurt him before was still in there with him, waiting.
"That was the worst thing about it," he said. "I knew it hated me, really hated me, beyond any sort of logic or reason. I knew it wished me harm. It wasn't even like being on an op and picking up an enemy fighter, seeing it come at you, a machine with a man in it doing his level best to blast you out of the sky. That was clean in comparison. There was a logic, a fairness to it. This was mean and spiteful and wrong. I couldn't have held a gun to it. I couldn't have raised a knife or a poker to it. The knife or the poker might have come to life in my hand. I felt as though the very blankets I was sitting on might rise up and throttle me."
He had kept it up for what might have been 30 minutes,
but what might as well have been 1,000.
Trembling and straining under the frightful effort of warding the malevolence off, and at last it had grown too much for him, and his nerve had snapped. He heard himself cry out for the thing to leave him, to leave him alone for God's sake, and the sound of his own voice appalled him. Perhaps it broke some sort of spell. He felt at once that something had shifted, that the dreadful thing had passed away. He looked at the objects around him, and,
"I can't explain it. I don't know how I knew it, but I knew that they were ordinary and lifeless again."
Utterly shattered, he drank a tumblerful of brandy, got under the covers of his bed, and curled up like a baby. His room, as it always did, had that muted feel to it, as if it were slightly insulated from the rest of the house. If presently there were sounds beyond his door, footsteps and anxious murmurs, he either didn't hear them or was too exhausted to consider what they might mean. He fell into a fretful sleep and was woken 2 hours later by Caroline. She had come to see how he was, and to tell him about the awful thing that had happened with Jip and Gillian. He listened to her story with mounting horror, realizing that the little girl must have been bitten at just about the time he had been calling out at that vicious presence in his room to leave him alone. He looked at me as he said this, his sore-looking eyes seeming to burn in his scarred face. He said,
"You understand? It was all my fault. I'd willed that thing away from me through sheer bloody gutlessness, and it had gone there to hurt someone else. That poor kid! If I had known, I'd have gone through anything, anything at all."
He wiped his mouth, then made an effort, and went on more levelly.
"I haven't let my guard slip again like that, I can tell you. Now when it comes, I'm ready. I've been keeping watch for it. Most days are all right. Most days it doesn't come at all. But it likes to surprise me, to catch me out. It's just like a sly, spiteful child. It sets traps for me. It opened the door of my room that time for me to walk into and bloody my nose. It moves my papers. It puts things in my path so that I'll stumble over them and break my neck. I don't mind about that. It can do what it wants to me. For so long as I can keep it, you see, in my room, I can contain the infection. That's the vital thing now, don't you agree? To keep the source of the infection away from my sister and my mother."
Chapter 6. There have been many times in my medical career when, on examining a patient, or on seeing the result of some test or other, it has gradually but ineluctably broken upon me that the case before me is a desperate one. I can think, for example, of a young married woman, just pregnant, who came to see me with a summer cough. I remember very vividly setting the stethoscope to her breast and hearing the first faint but devastating indications of tuberculosis. I can recall a handsome, talented boy brought to me with growing pains, actually the onset of a muscle-wasting illness which, within 5 years, was to take his life. The thickening tumour, the spreading cancer, the clouding eye. They are part of a family doctor's caseload alongside the rashes and the sprains, but I have never got used to them, never caught my first certain glimpse of them without the heaviest feeling of impotence and dismay. Something like that dismay began to creep upon me as I sat listening to Rod tell his extraordinary story. How long it took him, I'm not sure, for he spoke with a certain brokenness, a hesitation and reluctance, a shrinking from the ghastliness of the details of the thing. I kept silent for the most part, and when he had finished we sat together in that quiet room, and I glanced about me at the safe, familiar, fathomable world. The stove, the counter, the instruments and jars, old Gill's hand on their faded labels, mist silly, pot iod, and seemed to see it all grow slightly strange to me, all knocked slightly askew. Rod was watching me. He wiped his face, then made a ball of his handkerchief and worked it with his fingers, and said, "You wanted to know? I warned you what a filthy thing it was." I cleared my throat. "I'm very glad you told me."
"You are?"
"Of course. I only wish you'd done it sooner. It breaks my heart to think of you having gone through this alone, Rod."
"I had to, you see, for the sake of the family."
"Yes, I see that."
"And you don't judge me too badly over the girl? I swear to God, if I had known—"
"No, no. No one could blame you for that. There's just one thing I'd like to do now. I'd like to examine you, if I may."
"Examine me? Why?"
"I think you're pretty tired, aren't you?"
"Tired? God, I'm out on my feet. I hardly dare close my eyes at night. I'm frightened this thing will return if I do."
I had risen to fetch my bag, and as if in obedience to a signal, he began to draw off his sweater and shirt. He stood on the hearthrug in his vest and trousers with that dirty bandage on his wrist, rubbing his arms against the chill and looking shockingly thin and vulnerable and young. And I made a brief, basic examination, listening to his chest, reading his blood pressure and so on. But I did it, to be honest, mainly to buy myself a little time, for I could see, anyone could have seen what the real nature of his trouble was. What he had told me, in fact, had pretty well shaken me to the core, and I needed to think about how to proceed with him. As I'd guessed, there was nothing obviously wrong with him beyond the fact that he was underfed and overtired, and that was true of half my neighbours. I took my time putting my instruments away, still thinking. He stood buttoning up his shirt.
"Well?"
"You said it yourself, Rod. You're exhausted. And exhaustion, well, it does odd things to us, plays odd tricks." He frowned.
"Tricks?"
"Listen," I said, "I can't pretend to you that what you've told me has made me anything but extremely alarmed. I don't want to mince words with you. I think your problem is a mental one. I think—" "Listen to me, Rod." He'd begun to turn away, in disappointment and anger. "I think that what you've been experiencing can best be described as a sort of nerve storm. They're more common than you might think in certain overstressed people. And let's face it, you've been under an enormous pressure ever since you came out of the Air Force. I think that that pressure, combined with war shock—"
"War shock?"
he said scornfully. "Delayed war shock. That's more common than you would think, too." He shook his head, saying firmly,
"I know what I know. I know what I saw. You know what you think you saw. What your tired and overstretched nerves persuaded you to see. It wasn't like that. Don't you understand? God, I wish I'd said nothing. You asked me to tell you. I didn't want to, but you made me. Now you throw it back at me like this, making me out to be some sort of loony.
If you could just get a good night's sleep—"
"I told you, the thing will come back if I do."
"No, Rod. I promise you. It will only return if you don't, because it's a delusion—"
"A delusion? That's what you think?"
"A delusion which is feeding on your own tiredness. I think you should get away from the hall for a while. Right away. On some sort of holiday." He was pulling on his sweater, and when his face emerged from the neck of it, he looked at me in disbelief.
"Go away? Haven't you been listening to a single thing I've said? If I were to leave, who knows what would happen?"
He hastily smoothed down his hair and started putting on his overcoat. He'd caught sight of the clock.
"I've been away too long already. That's your fault, too. I must get back.
At least let me give you some luminol.
Dope? He said. You think that'll help me?
And then, with an edge to his voice, seeing me go to a shelf and bring down a tub of tablets.
No, I mean it. They pumped me full of those after my smash. I don't want them. Don't give them to me. I'll throw the damn things away.
You might change your mind.
I won't.
I came back around the counter empty-handed. Rod, please, listen to me. If I can't persuade you to leave the house... Well, there's a man I know, a good physician. He has a clinic in Birmingham for cases like yours. Let me bring him in to talk to you. To listen to you. That's all he'll want to do. Just listen to you while you talk to him as you spoke just now to me. His face had set.
A mental doctor, you mean? A psychiatrist, or psychologist, or whatever the hell you call them. That's not my trouble. The trouble isn't mine at all. The trouble's at Hundreds. Can't you see? I don't need a doctor so much as a...
He groped for a word.
A vicar or something. If you'd felt what I had...
I said on impulse, let me come with you, then. Let me spend some time in your room and see if this thing appears. He hesitated, thinking it over. And the sight of him doing that, treating the idea as if it were possible, sensible, reasonable, was almost more disturbing than anything else. But then he shook his head and spoke coldly again.
No, I can't risk it. I won't tempt it. It wouldn't like that.
He put on his cap.
I have to go. I'm sorry I told you any of this. I should have known you wouldn't understand.
Please, listen to me, Rod. The thought of losing him now was dreadful.
I can't let you go in this state of mind. Have you forgotten how you were just now? That dreadful panic?
Suppose that comes over you again. He said,
It won't. You caught me off guard, that's all. I shouldn't have come here in the first place. I'm needed at home.
At least talk to your mother, then, or let me talk to her for you.
No,
he said sharply. He had moved to the door, but now turned back to me, and, as once before, I was disconcerted to see real anger in his eyes.
She mustn't know about any of this, nor my sister. You're not to tell them. You said you wouldn't. You gave me your word, and I trusted you. You're not to talk to that doctor friend of yours, either. You say I'm going crazy. All right, go ahead and believe that, if it makes you feel better. If you're too much of a coward to face the truth. But at least have the decency to let me go crazy all by myself.
His tone was hard and level and absurdly rational-sounding. He put the strap of his satchel over his shoulder and drew together the lapels of his coat, and only the paleness of his face and the slight redness of his eyes hinted at the fantastic delusion that had him in its grip. Apart from that, he looked, as he'd looked before, like a youthful country squire. I knew there was no keeping him now. He had moved back to the dispensary door, but it was clear, from sounds beyond it, that the first of my evening patients were arriving, so he gestured impatiently to my consulting-room, and I took him in there to let him out into the garden. But I did it with a very heavy heart, and a dreadful sense of frustration. And as soon as the door was closed, I went back to the dispensary window and stood at the dusty net curtain to watch him reappear from around the side of the house and make his rapid, limping way along the high street to his car. What was I to do? It was clear to me, horribly clear, that over the past few weeks, Rod had been the victim of some very powerful hallucinations. That, in a sense, was hardly to be wondered at, given the dreadful mix of burdens he'd recently had to bear. Evidently the sense of threat and strain had overspilled in his mind, to the extent that even ordinary things, as he'd repeatedly put it, seemed to be rising up against him. That the delusion had first struck on the night he was meant to host a party for his more successful neighbour was perhaps no surprise, and I thought it sadly significant, too, that the worst of his experience had centred on a mirror, which, before it had started on its walk, had been reflecting his scarred face, and had ended up shattered. All this, as I say, was shocking enough, but could be explained away as the product of stress and nerve strain. More upsetting and worrying to my mind was the fact that he was still so attached to the delusion he had produced this logical-seeming fear that his mother and sister would be infected by whatever diabolical thing had supposedly invaded his room, unless he was there to ward it off. I spent the next few hours turning his condition over and over in my mind. Even as I sat with my other patients, a part of me seemed still to be with Rod, listening in horror and dismay as he told his dreadful story. I don't think there has ever been a time in my professional life when I have felt at such a loss as to how to proceed. No doubt my relationship with the family was interfering with my judgment. Probably I should have handed the case over at once to another man. But then, in what sense was it a case? Rod had not come to me that day for a medical opinion. He had, as he himself had pointed out, been unwilling to confide in me at all. And there was certainly no question of me or any other physician being paid for our assistance or advice. I didn't at this point suspect him of being a danger to himself or to others. I thought it much more likely that his delusion would slowly gather strength until it had finally consumed him, that he would wear himself, in other words, into a state of complete mental breakdown. My biggest dilemma was over what, if anything, to say to Mrs. Ayres and Caroline. I had given Rod my word that I would say nothing, and while I had been only half serious in comparing myself to a priest, no doctor takes a promise of secrecy lightly. I passed a terribly fretful evening, deciding now one thing and now another. Finally, at almost 10, I ran over to the Grahams' house to talk the matter through with them. I'd been spending less time with them lately, and Graham was surprised to see me. Anne, he said, was upstairs. One of their children was slightly unwell. But he took me into their sitting-room and heard the story through. He was as shocked by it as I had been. "How on earth did things get so bad? Were there no warning signs?" I said, "I knew something wasn't right, but not like this." "What do you mean to do next?" "That's what I'm trying to work out. I don't even have a firm diagnosis." He thought it over. "You've considered epilepsy, I suppose?" "It was my very first idea. I still think it might explain some of it. The aura, producing queer sensations, auditory, visual, and so on. The seizure itself, the weariness after, it all fits to a degree, but I can't believe it's the whole story." He said, "How about myxedema?" "I thought of that, too. But that's pretty hard to miss, isn't it? And there are no indications."
"Could something be interfering with the brain function? A tumour, for example?"
"Christ, I hope not."
"It's possible, of course. But again, there are no other signs."
"No. My hunch is it's purely nervous."
"That's just as bad, in its way."
I said, "I know. And his mother and sister have no idea. Do you think I should tell them? That's what's really troubling me." He shook his head, blowing out his cheeks.
"You know them better than I do now. Roderick certainly won't thank you for it. On the other hand, it might push him to some sort of crisis,
or put him completely out of reach.
That's certainly a risk. Why not take a day or two to think it over?"
"And meanwhile," I said gloomily, "things at Hundreds inch further into chaos."
"Well, that at least," he said, "isn't your problem."
His tone was rather detached. I could recall it from other conversations of ours about the Ayreses, but it slightly jarred with me now. I finished my drink and went slowly home, grateful to him for having listened, relieved to have shared the details of the case, but no wiser as to how to proceed. And it was only as I stepped into my dark dispensary and saw the two chairs still standing at the stove and seemed to hear again Rod's halting, desperate voice that the full force of his story came back to me. And I realized it was my plain duty to the family to give them at least some inkling of his condition as soon as I could. But it was a pretty dismal journey I made out to the house the following day. It seemed that all my business with the Ayreses just now lay either in warning them of something, or in carrying out some dreary undertaking on their behalf. With the return of daylight, too, there had come a slight failing in my resolve. I thought again of the promise I'd made, and I drove, if such a thing is possible, in a shrinking, reluctant sort of way, hoping more than anything not to encounter Rod himself, either there in the park or in the house. It was only a few days since my last visit, and neither Mrs. Ayres nor Caroline was expecting me. I found them both in the little parlour, but could see at once that, by turning up out of the blue like this, I had rather thrown them.
"Why, Doctor, you keep us on our toes," Mrs. Ayres said, raising a ringless hand to her face. "I shouldn't have dressed so weekdayishly if I had known you were coming. And have we anything in the kitchen, Caroline, to offer the doctor with his tea? I believe we've bread and margarine. You had better ring for Betty."
I hadn't wanted to telephone ahead for fear of alerting Roderick. and I was so used now to coming and going, to and from hundreds, it hadn't occurred to me that my visit might put them out. Mrs. Ayres spoke politely, but with a faintly querulous tone to her voice. I had never seen her so discomposed before. It was as if I'd surprised her without her charm, as well as without her powder and rings. But the reason for her touch of temper became clear in another moment, for in order to sit down I had to move aside several sagging, flat boxes from the sofa. They were boxes of old family photograph albums which Caroline had recently unearthed in one of the morning-room cupboards, and which had proved on inspection to be foxed with damp and spotted with mildew, and practically ruined.
"Such a tragedy," said Mrs. Ayres, showing me the crumbling pages. "There must be 80 years' worth of pictures here. Not just the Colonel's family, but my side too, the Singletons and Brooks. And, you know, I've been asking Caroline and Roderick for months to find these photographs out and make sure they were safe. I had no idea they were in the morning room at all. I thought they were locked away somewhere up in the attics."
I glanced at Caroline, who, after having rung for Betty, had returned to her chair and was turning the pages of a book of her own with a distant, patient air. Without lifting her eyes from the page before her, she said,
"They wouldn't have been any safer in the attics, I'm afraid. The last time I put my head up there, it was to take a look at some leak or other. There were baskets of books from when Roddy and I were children, all foxed to death." "Then I wish you had told me, Caroline. I'm sure I did, Mother, at the time. I know you have a great deal to think about, you and your brother, but this is awfully disappointing. Just look here, Doctor."
She handed me a stiff old carte de visite, its already quaint and faded Victorian subject now practically obscured by rust-coloured spots.
"Here's the Colonel's father as a young man. I used to think Roderick very like him."
"Yes," I said absently. I was tense now, waiting my chance to speak. "Where is Roderick, by the way?"
"Oh, in his room, I imagine."
She picked out another.
"Here's another one spoiled. This one, too. This one I remember. Oh, how dreadful! It's perfectly ruined. My own family, just before the war. My brothers are all there. Look, one can just make them out. Charlie, Lionel, Mortimer, Frank, and my sister, Sissy. I'd been married a year and was home with baby, and we didn't know it then, but the family was never to be together like that again. For within 6 months the fighting had started, and two of the boys were lost almost at once."
Her voice had changed, a note of real distress creeping into it, and this time Caroline looked up, and she and I exchanged a glance. Betty appeared and was sent off to bring the tea, which I didn't want and didn't have time for, and Mrs. Ayres continued to pick her way sadly and absently through the cloudy photographs. I thought of all she had recently been through, and what awful news I had come to break to her. I watched the fretful movement of her hands, which, without their rings, looked naked and large at the knuckle. And suddenly the idea of burdening her with yet another anxiety seemed too much. I remembered the conversation I'd had with Caroline about her brother the week before. It occurred to me that perhaps it was to her I should speak, at least in the first place. I spent a useless few minutes trying to catch her eye again. Then, once Betty had returned with the tea things, I rose as if to help with the tray, and took Caroline's cup across to her while Betty saw to Mrs. Ayres. And as Caroline looked up at me in mild surprise, putting out her hand to receive the saucer, I bent my head to her and whispered, "Can you find a way of talking to me alone?" She drew back, startled by the words, or simply by the movement of my breath against her cheek. She looked into my face, glanced at her mother, then gave me a nod. I went back to the sofa. We let 5 or 10 minutes pass while we drank our tea and ate the slim, dry slices of cake which had been served up with it. Then she moved forward as if just struck by an idea.
"Mother," she said, "I meant to tell you. I put some of our old books together to give to the Red Cross. I thought perhaps Dr. Faraday could take them back to Lidcote for us in his car. I don't like to ask Rod. I'm sorry to trouble you with it, Doctor, but would you mind? They're in the library, boxed up and ready."
She spoke without a flicker of self-consciousness, and with no trace of colour in her face, but I must confess my own heart was pounding. Mrs. Ayres said discontentedly that no, she supposed she wouldn't miss us for a minute or two, and went back to sorting through the crumbling albums.
"I won't keep you long,"
Caroline said to me, still in her ordinary voice, as I opened the door, but she gestured with her eyes along the passage, and we went quickly and softly together to the library, where she made her way to the window and drew back that single functioning shutter. As the wintry light spilled in, the shrouded bookshelves seemed to spring into life around us like rearing ghosts. I took a few steps forward out of the worst of the gloom, and Caroline came back away from the window to stand before me.
"Has something happened?" she asked me gravely. "Is it Rod?"
"Yes," I said, and I proceeded to tell her as briefly as I could everything her brother had confessed to me in my dispensary the night before. She listened in growing horror, but also, I thought, with a sort of dawning comprehension, as if my words made a ghastly sense to her, put into her hands the clue to a dark puzzle which up till now had been lying just out of her reach. The only time she interrupted me was when I repeated what Rod had said about the smudge appearing on his ceiling, and then she seized my arm and said,
"That mark, and the others, we saw them. I knew there was something odd about them. You don't think... it couldn't be..."
I realized with surprise that she was almost ready to take her brother's claims seriously. I said, "Anything could have made those marks, Caroline. Rod might have made them himself, simply to back up his own delusion, or maybe it was the marks appearing in the first place that set the whole thing off in his head." She drew her hand away.
"Yes, of course. And you really think that's how it is? It couldn't be what you said before? Seizures and so on?"
I shook my head. "I'd rather there were some physical problem here. It would be easier to treat, but I'm afraid that what we're dealing with is some kind of, well, mental illness." The words shocked her. She looked frightened for a second, then said,
"Poor, poor Rod. This is dreadful, isn't it? What on earth can we do? Do you mean to tell my mother?"
"I did. That's why I came out here. But seeing her with those photographs..."
"It isn't just the photographs, you know," she said. "Mother's changing. Most days she's quite her old self, but other days she's like this, vague and maudlin, thinking too much of the past. She and Rod have started almost quarrelling about the farm. Apparently there are new debts. He takes it all so personally, then he shuts himself away. Now I understand why. It's too horrible. He really said those frightful things, and meant them. You couldn't have misunderstood?"
I wish for all our sakes that I had. But no, I'm afraid there was no mistaking him. If he won't let me treat him, we can only hope that his mind will somehow clear itself. It might do, now that the Baker Hydes have left the county, and all that dreadful business is settled at last, though that's bad news about the farm. Certainly there's nothing I can do for him while he remains so fixated on this idea of his that he's protecting you and your mother.
You don't think, if I were to talk to him...
You might try. Though I shouldn't like you to have to hear what I heard from his own lips. Perhaps the best thing now is for you simply to keep an eye on him. For us both to watch him and hope to God he doesn't grow any worse.
And if he does?
She asked. If he does, I replied. Well, if this were another house with a more ordinary family in it, I know what I'd do. I'd bring in David Graham and have Rod forcibly committed to a psychiatric ward. She put a hand across her mouth.
It couldn't come to that, surely.
I'm thinking of those injuries of his. It looks to me like he's punishing himself. He clearly feels guilty, perhaps because of what's happening now with Hundreds, perhaps even because of what happened to his navigator back in the war. He might be trying to harm himself, almost unconsciously. On the other hand, he might be seeking our help. He knows what powers I have as a doctor. He might be hurting himself precisely in the hope that I'll step in and do something drastic. I stopped. We were standing in the faint light of the unshuttered window, and we had been talking tensely, in murmurs, all this time. Now, from somewhere over my shoulder, as if from the deepest shadows of the room, there came the small, sharp creak of metal. We both turned our heads to it, startled. The creak came again. It came, I realized, from the handle of the library door, which was slowly twisting in its socket. Seen through the gloom like that, in our already keyed-up condition, the thing looked almost uncanny. I heard Caroline draw in her breath and felt her move a little closer to me, as if afraid. As the door was pushed slowly open, and the light of the hall revealed Roderick standing there, I think we were both, for a second, relieved. Then we saw the expression on his face, and moved hastily apart. We looked, I suppose, about as guilty as we felt. Rod said coldly, "I heard your car, Doctor. I'd half expected it." And then to his sister, "What's he been telling you?"
that I'm touched, or cracked, or something. I suppose he's told Mother the same thing.
I haven't said anything to your mother yet, I said, before Caroline could answer.
Well, isn't that big of you?
He looked again at his sister.
He gave me his word, you know, that he wouldn't say anything at all. That's how much a doctor's word is worth, clearly. A doctor like him, anyway.
Caroline ignored that.
Roddy, she said, we are worried about you. You aren't yourself, you know you aren't. Come into the room, can't you? We don't want Mother or Betty to hear us.
He kept still for a moment, then moved forward, closed the door, and stood with his back to it. He said flatly,
"So you think I'm cracked, too?"
"I think you need a rest," said Caroline. "A break. Anything to get you away from here for a while."
"Away from here? You're as bad as him. Why is everyone trying to get me away?"
"We just want to help you. We think you must be ill and need treatment. Is it true you've been... seeing things?"
He lowered his gaze impatiently.
"God, it's just like after my smash. If I'm to be watched, endlessly watched, and fussed, and nannied..."
"Just tell me, Rod. Is it true you believe there's something... something in the house? Something that wants to hurt you?"
He didn't answer for a moment, but then he lifted his eyes to hers and said quietly,
"What do you think?"
And to my surprise I saw her flinch, as if from something in his gaze.
I don't know what to think. But, Rod, I'm frightened for you.
Frightened? You ought to be frightened, both of you, but not for me. Not of me, either, if that's what's worrying you. Don't you understand? I'm all that's holding this place together.
I said, "I know it seems that way to you, Rod. If you just let us help you."
"This is your idea of helping me, is it? Running straight to my sister? When you promised..."
"This is my idea of helping you, yes. Because I've been turning it over in my mind, and I don't think you're in a position to help yourself."
"But don't you see? How can you not see after all I told you yesterday? It isn't myself I'm thinking of. God, I've never been given any credit for the work I've done for this family. Not even now, when I'm thrashing myself to death. Perhaps I should pack the whole thing in, close my eyes for once, look the other way. Then we'll see what happens."
He sounded almost sulky now, like a boy trying to argue down a bad school report. He folded his arms and hunched his shoulders, and the darkness and the horror of what we were actually talking about, which a moment before had felt so palpable, began somehow to slip away from us. I saw Caroline looking at me for the first time with doubt in her eyes, and I took a step forward, saying urgently,
"Rod, you must understand, we're desperately worried. This can't go on."
"I don't want to talk about it," he said firmly. "There's no point."
"I think you're really ill, Rod. We need to work out exactly what the illness is, so that we can cure it."
"All that's making me ill is you and your prying. If you'd let me alone, if you'd just let all of us alone. But you two have always been in league against me. All that gaff about my leg, saying I was doing the hospital a favour."
"How can you say that," said Caroline, "when Dr. Faraday was so kind?"
"Is he being kind now?
Rod, please."
"I told you, didn't I? I don't want to talk about it."
He turned to wrench open the heavy old library door and go out, and as he went he gave the door such a slam, a line of dust came down like a veil from a crack in the ceiling, and two of the sheets slid from the bookshelves to land in a musty heap on the floor. Caroline and I looked helplessly at each other, then went slowly across to lift the sheets back out.
"What can we do?" she asked me as we fastened them. "If he's really as bad as you say he is, but won't let us help him?"
"I don't know," I answered. "I truly don't know. We can only, as I said before, watch him, and hope to try and regain his trust. Most of that will fall to you, I'm afraid." She nodded, then gazed into my face, and after a little hesitation she said,
"You are sure about what he told you? He sounds so sane."
"I know he does. If you'd seen him yesterday, you wouldn't think that. And yet, even then he spoke so reasonably. I swear it's the strangest mix of sanity and delusion I've ever seen."
"And you don't think there couldn't be anything really, any truth in what he's saying?"
Again I was surprised that she would even consider such a thing. I said, "I'm sorry, Caroline. It's terribly hard when this sort of thing happens to a person one loves."
"Yes, I suppose so."
She spoke doubtfully, then put her hands together, working the thumb of one over the knuckles of the other, and I saw her shiver. I said, "You're cold." But she shook her head.
"Not cold. Frightened."
With an uncertain movement, I put my own hands over hers. At once her fingers moved gratefully against mine. I said, "I didn't mean to frighten you. I'm so sorry to burden you with this." I glanced around. "This house is gloomy on a day like today." "That's probably part of Rod's trouble. If only he hadn't let things slip so far. And now..."
"Damn!"
Frustrated, I caught sight of the time. "I have to go. You'll be all right, and you'll let me know at once if anything changes." She promised she would.
"Good girl,"
I said, squeezing her fingers. Her hands stayed in mine for another second, then slid away. We headed back to the little parlour.
"What an age you've been," said Mrs. Ayres as we went in. "And what on earth was that great crash? Betty and I supposed the roof was falling in."
She had the girl at her side. She must have kept her back when she came to take away the tea tray, or perhaps had rung for her deliberately. She was showing her the spoilt photographs, had laid out half a dozen of them, apparently pictures of Caroline and Roderick as infants, and now began to pick them impatiently back up. Caroline said,
"I'm sorry, Mother. I let a door slam. Now there's dust, I'm afraid, on the library floor. Betty, you'll have to see to that."
Betty put down her head and gave a curtsy.
"Yes, miss,"
she said, moving off. Not having any time to linger, I said a polite but hasty goodbye, meeting Caroline's gaze and trying to will into my expression all the sympathy and support I could, and more or less followed her. I reached the hall and glanced in through the open library door and saw her down on her knees with a dustpan and brush, dabbing without enthusiasm at the threadbare carpet. And it was only as I saw the dipping and rising of her slender shoulders that I remembered that queer outburst of hers on the morning I had destroyed Jip. It seemed a strange coincidence that her claim that hundreds had a bad thing in it should have found an echo now in Roderick's delusion. I went in and spoke quietly to her, wanting to know if she had said anything that might have put the germ of an idea into his head. She swore she had said nothing.
"You told me not to, didn't you?"
she said.
"Well, I haven't said a word."
"Not even in fun?"
"No."
She spoke with great earnestness, but also, I thought, with the faintest touch of relish. I recalled suddenly what a good little actress she was. I looked into her shallow grey eyes, and for the first time I was uncertain whether her gaze were guileless or sly. I said,
"You're quite sure now. You haven't been saying anything or doing anything just to liven things up, moving things around, putting things where they oughtn't to be?" "I haven't done nothing," she said, "and I haven't said nothing. I don't like to think of it anyhow. It makes me frit if I think about it when I'm downstairs on my own. It ain't my bad thing. That's what Mrs. Baisley says. If I don't go bothering him, she says, he won't come bothering me."
And I had to be satisfied with that. She went back to dabbing at the carpet. I stood and watched her for a few moments longer, then left the house. I spoke to Caroline several times over the following week or two. She told me that nothing much had changed, that Rod was as secretive as ever, but apart from that, quite rational. And he himself, on my next visit, came to the door of his room when I knocked on it, only to tell me in sober tones that he had nothing to say to me and simply wanted to be left alone. Then closing the door, with horrible finality, in my face. My interference, in other words, had had exactly the effect I'd feared most. There was no question now of my continuing with the treatment of his leg. I finished my writing up of the case and submitted my paper, and without that reason to call at the house my visits rather fell away. I found myself missing them, surprisingly badly. I missed the family. I missed hundreds itself. I worried about poor, burdened Mrs. Ayres, and I thought often of Caroline, wondering how on earth she could be coping out there with things so bad, thinking back to that time in the library, and remembering the tired, reluctant way her hand had moved away from mine. December arrived, and the weather grew more wintry. There was an outbreak of influenza in the district, the first of the season. Two of my elderly patients died, and several others were badly affected. Graham came down with the illness himself. Our locum, Wise, took on some of his workload, but the rest of his rounds were added to mine, and I was soon working every spare hour.
For the first few days of the month I got no nearer to the Hall than the Hundreds Farm, where Makins's wife and daughter were both lying ill, the milking suffering as a result of it. Makins himself was sour and grumbling, talking of throwing in the whole business. He hadn't seen hide nor hair of Roderick Ayres, he told me, for 3 or 4 weeks, not since the most recent rent day when he had come to collect his money.
"That's the so-called gentleman farmer for you," he said bitterly. "When the sun is shining, all's well and good. The first trace of bad weather, and he's at home with his feet up."
He would have gone grumbling on. I didn't have time to stay and listen. I didn't have time, either, to call in at the Hall, as I would once have done, but what Makins had told me had worried me, and that night I telephoned the house. Mrs. Ayres answered, sounding weary.
"Oh, Dr. Faraday," she said, "how nice it is to hear your voice. We've had no visitors in ages. This weather makes everything so hard. The house is so comfortless just now."
"But you're all right?" I asked. "All of you? Caroline? Rod?"
"We're fine."
I spoke to Makins. The line crackled.
"You must come and see us," she called through the interference. "Will you? Come and dine. We'll give you a proper old-fashioned dinner. Should you like that?"
I called back that I should very much. The line was too bad for us to continue. We fixed on a date between crackles for 2 or 3 days off. The weather in that short time seemed only to decline. It was a wet, blowy night, moonless and starless, when I went up to Hundreds again. I don't know if the damp and the darkness were to blame, or whether, in keeping away for a while, I had forgotten how really shabby and neglected the house had become, but when I stepped into the hall the cheerlessness of it struck me at once. Some of the bulbs in the wall lights had blown, and the staircase climbed into shadows just as it had on the evening of the party. The effect now was a strangely lowering one, as if the inclement night itself had found a way in through seams in the brickwork and had gathered to hang like smoke or must in the very core of the house. It was also piercingly cold. A few ancient radiators were bubbling and ticking away, but their heat was lost as soon as it rose. I went along the marble-floored passage and found the family gathered in the little parlour, their chairs drawn right up to the hearth in their efforts to keep warm, and their outfits eccentric. Caroline with a short cape of balding sealskin over her dress, Mrs. Ayres in a stiff silk gown and an emerald necklace and rings, with clashing Spanish and Indian shawls around her shoulders and on her head her black mantilla, and Roderick with an ointment-coloured woollen waistcoat underneath his evening jacket, and a pair of fingerless gloves on his hands.
"Forgive us, Doctor," said Mrs. Ayres, coming forward as I went in. "I'm ashamed to think how we must look."
But she said it lightly, and I could tell from her manner that, in fact, she had no idea how truly outlandish she and her children appeared. That made me uneasy, somehow. I suppose I was seeing them all, as I'd seen the house, as a stranger might. I looked closest at Rod, and was pretty dismayed by what I saw. When his mother and sister greeted me, he hung back, pointedly, and though he did shake my hand at last, he did it limply, without speaking, and barely raising his eyes to mine, so that I could see he only meant to go through the motions of making me welcome, perhaps for his mother's sake. But all this I'd expected. There was something else which troubled me more. His whole manner had changed. Where before he'd carried himself in the tense, hunted way of someone braced against disaster, now he seemed to slouch, as if barely caring whether disaster struck or not. While Mrs. Ayres and Caroline and I chatted together with an attempt at normality of county matters and local gossip, he sat the whole time in his chair, watching us from under his brows, but saying nothing. He rose only once, and that was to go to the drinks table to top up his glass of gin and French. And from the way he handled the bottles, and from the stiffness of the cocktail he mixed, I realized that he must have been drinking steadily for some time. It was horrible to see. Presently Betty came to call us to dinner, and in the movement which followed I drew close to Caroline and murmured, "Everything all right?" She glanced at her mother and brother, then gave a tight shake of her head. We stepped out into the passage, and she drew close the collar of her cape against the chill which seemed to rise up from the marble floor. We were to eat in the dining-room, and Mrs. Ayres, in order, I suppose, to make good her promise to give me a proper old-fashioned dinner, had had Betty lay the table rather elaborately, with Chinese porcelain to match the oriental paper on the walls,
and with ancient silverware. The ormolu candelabra were lit, and the flames of their candles dipped alarmingly in the draught from the windows. Caroline and I sat face to face across the width of the table between them, while Mrs. Ayres took her place at the table's foot. Roderick made his way to the master's chair, his father's old chair, I suppose it was, at the head of it. Almost as soon as he had sat down, he poured himself a glass of wine, and when Betty had taken the bottle to the other end of the table and approached him with a tureen of soup, he put his hand across his bowl.
"Oh, take the nasty soup away. I won't have any soup today," he said in a foolish, jarring voice. Then, "Do you know what happened to the naughty boy in that poem, Betty?"
"No, sir," she said uncertainly.
"No, sir," he repeated, mimicking her accent. "Well, he was burned in a fire."
"No, he wasn't," said Caroline, with an attempt at a smile. "He wasted away. Which is what you'll do, Rod, if you're not careful, though goodness knows I don't think any of us would care. Have some soup."
"I told you," he answered, putting on his silly voice again, "I won't have any soup today. But you may bring back the wine, please, Betty. Thank you."
He topped up his glass. He did it heavily, the neck of the bottle striking the glass and making it ring. The glass was a lovely, Regency one, brought out of storage, I imagine, along with the porcelain and the silver, and at the little concussion Caroline's smile faded, and she looked at her brother, suddenly, with real annoyance, so that I was almost startled by the flash of distaste in her eyes. Her gaze stayed hard, then, for the rest of the meal, and I thought it a pity, for in the light of the candles she looked her best, with her heavy features softened and the angular lines of her collarbones and shoulders concealed by the folds of her cape. Mrs. Ayres, too, was flattered by the candlelight. She said nothing to her son, but kept up a light, smooth flow of conversation with me, just as she had in the little parlour. I thought this simply a sign of good breeding at first. I supposed she was embarrassed by Rod's behaviour and was doing her best to cover it up. Gradually, though, I became aware of a certain brittleness to her tone, and I remembered then what Caroline had told me, that time in the library, about her mother and brother having started quarrelling, and I found myself wishing, what I couldn't remember ever having done before at Hundreds, I found myself wishing that I hadn't come out there, and I began to long for the meal to end. The house, I thought, didn't deserve their bad feeling, and neither did I. Presently Mrs. Ayres and I fell to talking about a patient I'd recently been treating for the influenza, an old Hundreds tenant who lived a quarter of a mile from the west gates. I said how lucky it was that I was able to use that road across the park in order to reach him, that it made a great difference to my round. Mrs. Ayres agreed, then added cryptically, "I do so hope that's allowed to continue."
"You do?" I asked, surprised.
"Well, why shouldn't it?" She looked pointedly at her son, as if expecting him to speak. He said nothing, only gazed into his wine-glass, so she dabbed at her mouth with her linen napkin, then went on,
"I'm afraid, Doctor, that Roderick's had to give me some unhappy news today. The fact is, it looks as though we'll soon be obliged to sell off more of our land."
"You will?" I said, turning to Rod.
"I thought there wasn't any more to sell. Who's the buyer this time?"
"The county council again," said Mrs. Ayres, when Rod didn't answer, "with Maurice Babb to build as before. Their plans for 24 extra houses. Can you imagine? I thought the regulations would forbid it. They seem to forbid everything else. But it seems this government is quite happy to hand out permits to men who intend to break up parklands and estates so that they might cram 24 families into 3 acres of ground. It will mean putting a breach in the wall, laying pipes, and so on."
"The wall?" I said, not understanding. Caroline spoke.
"Rod offered them farmland," she said quietly, "and they didn't want it. They'll only take the grass snake field over to the west. They finally made up their minds, you see, about the water and electricity. They say they won't extend the mains to Hundreds simply for our use, but they'll bring them out if it's for the sake of new houses. It seems we might just be able to raise the money to lay the pipes and wires the extra distance to the farm."
For a moment I was too dismayed to answer. The grass snake field, as I knew Caroline and Roderick had named it as children, was just within the park wall, about 3/4 of a mile from the house itself. It had been hidden from view in high summer, but with the thinning of the trees in autumn it became visible from all the south and west-facing windows of the hall, a distant swathe of green and white and silver, rippling and lovely as fingered velvet. The thought that Rod was seriously prepared to give it up bothered me horribly. "You can't mean it," I said to him. "You simply can't break up the park. There must be some